in Vrindavan. And today we're doing, we're covering chapter 30, well, a little bit from the end of chapter 36, and then chapter 37, which is the killing of the demons Keshi and Vyoma. These are the last of the Vrindavan demons Krishna's going to polish off today. So, Krishna, 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 hey. Krishna, 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 hey. Krishna, 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 Rakshama. Krishna, 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 Pahima. Rama, Raghava, Rama, Raghava, Rama, Raghava, Rakshama. Krishna, Keshava, Krishna, Keshava, Krishna, Keshava, Pahima. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're starting here from chapter 36, text 17. Krishna just killed the Arishtasura, the bull demon. And after that, he enacted the beautiful pastime of the appearance of Shyamakund and Radhakund. And so after this, Narada Muni goes to, Narada Muni understands that Krishna is winding up his Vraj Leela, his Vrindavan Leela. And Narada is actually very eager for him to move on to Mathura and take care of business over there. So he's trying to expedite the pastimes. And what he does is he goes to Kamsa. This looks like Narada's being a traitor, but he's just trying to speed up the pastimes and get the ball rolling, so to speak. Make sure that Krishna doesn't stay in Vrindavan forever. although he does, but that's another story. So Narada Muni goes to Kamsa and he basically spills the beans about all the episodes that happened. That, you know, that eighth son of Devaki that was supposed to kill you? Well, the eighth son, because Kamsa is thinking that Devaki's eighth child was a girl, because that's what he saw. So Narada says, actually, Devaki did have a son, and Vasudev snuck out and took that son over to Gokul and left with Yashoda, and Yashoda had a daughter, and the girl that you saw and tried to kill and who manifested as Durga Devi, that was actually Yashoda's child. So yeah, and all these demons that you've sent to Vrindavan were killed by this very person who is Krishna, the son of Vasudev and Devaki. And so then when Krishna hears that, Kamsa hears this, he becomes really furious, because he's like, not only is he just by nature furious because he's a demon, but and not only is he furious because someone out there is going to kill him, but now he's even more angry because he understands, he's thinking that Vasudev cheated him. And Vasudev was someone that he actually thought was true to his word. So he's thinking, oh, I've been cheated. And now this is just terrible. And Kamsa wants to immediately kill Vasudev. But then Narada says, wait, hold on. Don't kill Vasudev and Devaki, because they're not going to kill you. They're no threat to you. They're no danger. And if you kill them now, then that's less of a chance that Krishna is ever going to come to Mathura as long as, because they're his mother and father. So eventually he's going to come here, and them being alive in Mathura is a good impetus for Krishna to bring Krishna here. So you better keep them alive if you want to get Krishna here. Basically, that's what he's saying. So then Kamsa doesn't kill them, but he sends Keshi. So he calls the Keshi demon. He says, go there and kill Krishna and Balaram too. And then he also calls his ministers and he tells them to arrange for this wrestling match between Chanura and Mushtika and Krishna and Balaram. And he also calls Akrura to go and get Krishna and bring them to Mathura for this wrestling match. So Kamsa is making his schemes, and he has this idea to kill anybody who's favorable towards Krishna, and then establish all of his demoniac friends like Jarasandha and Dravida Gorilla, of all people, and others, Narakasura and Banasura, all of his allies, as the rulers of all the provinces and just get rid of Ugrasen, get rid of Devika and Vasudev and everybody who's on Krishna's side. So Kamsa's thinking that he's got it all figured out. And he says, so he lays out his plan to Akrura. And then he says, Kamsa says, then my friend, this earth will be free from thorns. It's a very short verse. It's just a two-liner, rare two-line verse in the Bhagavatam, text 35. Kamsa's thinking, then this earth, it's Krishna and Nandamaraj and Vasudeva and Devaki and Ugrasen and all their family and all their support, they're all just thorns. And when they're removed, then the world will be nice. It'll be pleasant to live in. So then Akrura, he agrees to go get Krishna because he's ultimately a devotee of Krishna. So he's happy to go and see Krishna. And we're going to read about that tomorrow. But he, in a subtle way, he indicates to Kamsa that his evil plan is not going to be a success. He says in text 38, O king, you have expertly devised a process to free yourself of misfortune. Still, one should be equal in success and failure, since it is certainly destiny that produces the results of one's work. So he's like, you've got a good plan, but basically man proposes and God disposes. So, you know, be prepared that to be equipoised in success and failure, because you may not be successful. And he goes on to say that an ordinary person is determined to act on his desires, even when fate prevents their fulfillment. Therefore, he encounters both happiness and distress. Yet even though such is the case, I will execute your order. So he's almost saying that you're going to fail here. He's like, you are very determined to act on your desire to kill Krishna, even when fate is preventing its fulfillment. In other words, even though this is just totally an ill-fated plan, it's never going to be successful. But in any case, I'll go. So then, like that, that chapter ends like that. But Kamsa has ordered Keshi to go to Vrindavan. And Keshi is this, Keshi is this giant horse demon. So he's kind of similar in some ways to Aristasura, in that he goes into Vrindavan, you know, in this rage, and he's with his hoofs, he's digging up the ground, and his tail is touching the clouds. So it's kind of very similar to Aristasura, but in the form of a horse. And this is Kamsa's last kick at Krishna, basically. So it's just like, you know, two fighters, wrestlers or boxers in the ring, when they realize that they're going to be defeated, or they think, oh, this is not looking good for me. Then they muster up all their energy and they kind of give a final punch or a final kick before dying. So this is what Kamsa is doing. He's thinking, all right, my last resort. I've used up almost all of my demons. There are only two demons left. So you go there. So Keshi, the anarta that Keshi represents is the anarta of spiritual pride, or so-called spiritual pride. So it's pride of thinking that you're a great devotee, or even thinking that you're like the next acharya, and that you basically, that you know better than the previous acharyas. And because you know better, then you're going to start your own movement or start your own spiritual path. And an example of this is back in the 80s, there was a group of devotees that, they challenged the authority of the GBC and the gurus in ISKCON, the whole guru system. And they, they're the ones who came up with this whole, the Ritvik philosophy. And they actually started their own community in North America. And they started their own publication in which they, I don't know if it's the same one, back to Prabhupada, it might be the same one, but they started their own publication in which they, you know, proposed this Ritvik theory. The Ritvik theory means the idea that only Srila Prabhupada is the guru, and that all of the gurus that might come after Prabhupada, who pose as gurus, are not actually Diksha gurus in their own right, but they're just officiating priests, or in Sanskrit, the officiating priest is called a Ritvik. So they're these officiating priests who are initiating the disciples on Srila Prabhupada's behalf. So they perform the ceremony, but those people are actually Prabhupada's disciples even though Srila Prabhupada is no longer in this world. So that's the Ritvik theory, and it's totally not substantiated by any Shastra or any historical precedent, and nor by Srila Prabhupada. So it's totally bogus. But these people, out of pride, they thought that this was a better system and they knew better, so they were propagating it. And so it's almost like it's like keshi, you know, this spiritual pride that we know better. And so one GBC member, Ravinda Swarup Prabhu, who's very faithful, very loyal to Srila Prabhupada and to ISKCON, he was called upon to write an article to counteract the Ritvik philosophy. And so he made the comment at the time that that it was like sending out a challenge horse. So we know that Maharaj Yudhisthira, before performing the Rajasuya sacrifice, he also sent out a challenge horse to see that if anybody can defeat me, then you know, there'll be a fight, or otherwise either surrender or prepare to fight with me. So that's the chat. But this, the Ritviks, their cha he said that the Ritviks, their challenge horse was not like Yudhisthira's challenge horse, but it was more like Keshi. That horse was like the Keshi demon, because it was based on this spiritual pride, and it was actually averse to real Krishna consciousness. It was in some ways demoniac. So, yes. But just as Krishna, you know, he's going to grab this Keshi demon by the legs and throw him far away, we're going to read about in a minute. So, devotees in the service of Krishna, we need to seize these deviant philosophies and throw them far away, you know, to counteract them with strong Shastric arguments and examples, and that way educate the devotees and drive these dangerous philosophical elements far away from our movement. Okay, so let's get into the story here a little bit. That fairly long prelude. Text one and two. Shukadeva Goswami said, "The demon Keshi, sent by Kamsa, appeared in Vraja as a great horse, running with the speed of the mind. He tore up the earth with his hooves." So this is also another thing about these deviant philosophies, is that they travel very fast. You know, somebody speaks something and, oh, did you hear that? It's like gossip, you know, that or bad news, like bad news travels fast. So bad philosophies also travel fast somehow. That they become propagated very quickly throughout the ranks and files of the devotees. So like Keshi, running with the speed of the mind. And also these things are just produced of the mind. They're just mental concoctions. They don't have any Shastric authority. So they're created by the mind, but they travel by the speed of the mind. And then Keshi tore up the earth with his hooves. So these philosophies threaten to tear up devotees' faith in the authorized process of Krishna consciousness. So continuing here, the hairs of Keshi's mane scattered the clouds and the demigods' airplanes throughout the sky, and he terrified everyone present with his loud neighing. Demigods were afraid. We hear about how the demigods are always kind of, the demigods are always watching from above to see Krishna's pastimes, and they're hovering around in their airplanes. And the hairs of his mane, so that's like on his neck. That means his hairs were going so high into the clouds that when he ran, they were flopping here and there and like a broom, you know, scattering the demigods' airplanes. When the Supreme Personality of Godhead saw how the demon was frightening his village of Gokul by neighing terribly and shaking the clouds with his tail, the Lord came forward to meet him. Keshi was searching for Krishna to fight. So when the Lord stood before him and challenged him to approach, the horse responded by roaring like a lion. So, seeing the Lord standing before him, Keshi ran towards him in extreme rage, his mouth gaping as if to swallow up the sky. Rushing with furious speed, the unconquerable and unapproachable horse demon tried to strike the lotus-eyed Lord with his two front legs. So here we see that Keshi is not, he's just rushing straight in for the kill, furious speed. And it says the unconquerable and unapproachable horse demon. There's a little bit of glorification here, Keshi, that to get us to understand that previous to this, Keshi has never been conquered. Nobody was ever able to defeat him. And that's also why Keshi is very proud, is because he's undefeatable. Nobody would even approach him to fight with him because he was just too much of a force to be reckoned with. And he tries to kick Krishna with his front legs. He rears up on his hind legs like horses do, and he tries to kick him with his front legs. But the transcendental Lord dodged Keshi's blow, and then with his arms angrily seized the demon by the legs. So the same legs that he was trying to kick Krishna with, Krishna grabbed hold of those, whirled him around in the air, and contemptuously threw him the distance of 100 bow lengths, just as Garuda might throw a snake. Lord Krishna then stood there. So here it's a significant name of Krishna that's used in the first line, Adokshaja. Adokshaja means one who cannot be approached by the material senses or material mind. So this is also on this theme, you know, of deviant philosophies, that we cannot approach Krishna by our own methods. We can't think that we can come up with our own philosophy or our own process, and by following that philosophy and that process, that we're going to actually achieve Krishna, that we're going to become pure devotees, that we're going to go back to Godhead. It's not going to work because Krishna is adokshaja. He can't be approached by any of these, by the mind or senses. He can't be approached by any mentally concocted philosophy. So, yeah. The thing is that we can only understand Krishna when Krishna reveals himself. And the way to get Krishna to reveal himself is to follow the process that Krishna actually gives, that is revealed in the scriptures, and that is, passed on by the acharyas. So that's why this guru, sadhu, and shastra is very important. And also following in the footsteps of the acharyas. We're just reading, like, Sato Vritte is one of the six principles favorable to devotional service, following in the footsteps of the previous acharyas. If we try to be our own acharya, then we're just going to fail. We're just going to be like a spark that shoots out of the fire and gets quickly extinguished. Or like Keshi, that gets thrown far away. And that's what happens. You know, we see devotees in ISKCON that they come up with their own ideas, and then they end up just having to leave Srila Prabhupada's International Society for Krishna Consciousness. They have to leave Srila Prabhupada's movement and start their own movement, and then they just become weak and they fizzle out. They may have a charismatic leader for some time and they may get some followers, but then after the death of the charismatic leader, then the whole thing loses its steam. So it's best to stick with the acharya, stick with Srila Prabhupada's movement, because we see that ISKCON is expanding, it's growing, it's spreading, it's going strong, even after Srila Prabhupada left this world many years ago. So, yeah, this requires some humility, that, you know, things within ISKCON may not go exactly the way we want them to go, or we may feel like there's some mistakes being made, but still we need to control our mind and try to see the good things and overlook the faults and try to be part of the solution and not the problem, and don't go and start our own independent thing. Don't be a Keshi thinking we know better. Okay, text 5. Upon regaining consciousness, so Krishna threw Keshi, but he didn't kill him yet. He just threw him, and Keshi kind of like, he landed on the ground and temporarily lost consciousness. But now upon regaining consciousness, Keshi angrily got up, opened his mouth wide, and again rushed to attack Lord Krishna. But the Lord just smiled and thrust his left arm into the horse's mouth as easily as one would make a snake enter a hole in the ground. Yeah, so Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur describes that Krishna held up his arm just like you would hold up a carrot for a horse to eat. So that's the way, like, they make a horse keep walking, is to hold a dangle a carrot in front of his face at some distance, and then he's trying to get the carrot. So Krishna is like, he puts his arm up like, oh, you want to eat something? Eat this. You can eat my arm. And then Keshi runs toward him with his open mouth. So he's like, all right, I'm going to eat that arm. I'm going to bite your arm right off and kill you. And then it says that when Keshi got close enough, he just put his arm in Keshi's mouth very gracefully, like a snake going into its hole. If you ever seen a snake go, it's like it's very slips right in, like zoop, so very gracefully. And then, so then when Krishna put his hand in Keshi's mouth, then he made it become very hot. And usually Krishna's body is very cool and soothing and pleasing, but for Keshi, he made it very hot, like molten iron. And also that his hand expanded a little bit. So Keshi clamped his jaws down onto Krishna's hand. And then when his hand expanded, because the mouth was closed, then it forced all of his teeth out. So all of Keshi's teeth just went clink, falling out onto the ground. And that also is the removal of his teeth signifies also the removal of his pride, because you know it's hard to be proud when you're toothless. just gumming it. So Keshi's teeth immediately fell out when they touched the Supreme Lord's arm, which to the demon felt as hot as molten iron. Within Keshi's body, the Supreme Personality's arm then expanded greatly, like a diseased stomach swelling because of neglect. And so Krishna and Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur says that his arm felt extremely hot, as if made of lightning bolts. So it's often said that Krishna's as soft as a rose for the devotees, but he's as hard as a thunderbolt for the demons. So here his tender, soft arm is becoming hard as a, and as hot as a thunderbolt. As Lord Krishna's expanding arm completely blocked Keshi's breathing, his legs kicked convulsively, his body became covered with sweat, and his eyes rolled around. The demon then passed stool and fell on the ground dead. So that's the end of Keshi. The mighty arm Krishna withdrew his arm from Keshi's body, which now appeared like a long karkatika fruit. I don't know what that is. You could look it up. Without the least display of pride at having so effortlessly killed his enemy, the Lord accepted the demigod's worship in the form of flowers rained down from above. So while Keshi was busy fighting, then the demigods were able to get themselves back into formation there and watch and get ready to shower flowers. But it's very significant here that Keshi represents false pride, or you know, the so-called spiritual pride. Whereas Krishna, even after killing Keshi, it says he does so without the least display of pride at having so effortlessly killed this unconquerable, unapproachable demon, Keshi. So pride, as it says, pride cometh before a fall. And that happened with Keshi. And it also could happen with us. So we have to be very careful of this. And there's a verse in the Chaitanya Charitamrita where Lord Chaitanya says that as we chant, chanting and hearing Krishna's names and glories waters the creeper of devotion. But we have to be careful, because in the course of watering our bhakti lata, our devotional creeper, there are also some weeds that can grow along with that. And these weeds that he mentions are, most of them are related to pride. So the three, there are three, labha, puja, and pratishta that are mentioned there. This is from Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhyalila, chapter 19, text 159. So labha means profit, like gain. Generally, these three are called profit, adoration, and distinction. So profit means that I'm getting some material benefit from my devotional service and becoming proud of that. Like, yes, I'm raking in money. I'm getting position. I'm getting famous, like that. So it's all linked to pride. And then puja means adoration. Oh, people are admiring me for such a great devotee. They're, you know, they are worshiping me. They're honoring me. They're appreciating my classes, and they're seeing what an advanced Vaishnava I am. So that's all puja, being adored. And then pratishta means distinction, that you get an attitude that, wow, because, you know, I'm so accomplished and because I'm so honored, then I must be better than everybody. I must be like a cut above all the other, devotees, and I'm really somebody special. So these are all weeds, and it's not. See, the Keshi demon is interesting because he's a demon, but the anarthas that he represents are not like just the demoniac qualities that we used to think of, like lust and greed and envy and all those. But it's like it's these things that come as like byproducts of devotional service that arise in the course of devotional service. So these are little subtle demoniac qualities that can influence devotees and that can cause us to fall down. So to be very careful of these things. And yeah, that's why, like the examples that I was giving, they were devotees. So these are big problems. So then Krishna is showing that even although he just accomplished a great thing, he just killed this unconquerable demon, but he's not proud. So he's setting a good example that even if we may do great things, even though we may be able to do accomplish things that nobody else has ever been able to do before, and we did it so wonderfully, we did it so effortlessly and brilliantly, and people are applauding us and praising us, but still we should not be proud because Krishna wasn't. Yes, Evan.
Is this like most anarthas when like it's inevitable that they'll come up, but you'll just need to, I guess, be aware of them? Or is it that like they might not come up?
I mean, generally, if you stay in Krishna consciousness long enough, people are going to honor you and you'll get some material benefits. You'll get donations, you might accumulate money, you might be given properties and all sorts of things. We see that Prabhupada did, right? He started the movement with nothing, and by the end he had all these so many material assets. So, and so much worship, like literally he was worshiped, Guru Puja in every temple every day, and distinction also was there. He was like, if you compare Prabhupada to all of his disciples at the time when Prabhupada was here, it was like, forget it, there was just no comparison. But Prabhupada was never proud. So the thing is that these things will come. They basically, for most devotees, they will come. But the problem is that, what we need to bear in mind is that we shouldn't become proud of these. We should always remember that any wealth that we get is Krishna's. Any adoration that we get is not for me, but it's for, my predecessors. We pass it up the disciplic succession because without our gurus, without the devotees that trained us and made us devotees and helped us along the way, all of our mentors, who would I be? Actually, they're the ones who deserve to be honored. And then as far as distinction, it's like, who am I? Like Prabhupada took Tamal Krishna Maharaj through that thing, like, there are so many universes, and in one universe there are so many planets, and in one planet there's so many countries, and in one country there's so many cities, and in one city there's so many neighborhoods, in one neighborhood there's so many houses, and each house there's so many rooms, and in one room this Tamal Krishna Maharaj is sitting and thinking he's very important. So if he would compare, I mean, at that time Tamal Krishna was doing amazing things. He really was like, an amazing leader, an amazing devotee, and he was, objectively speaking, you could say that he was very distinguished. But if we look at things in a broader context, then who are we? We're just a tiny speck, and literally 1/10,000th the size of a tip of a hair, not even a speck, a microscopic little.
I guess I'm wondering more about the arousal of pride. Yeah, these things will come, but will the arousal of pride be inevitable, or will it be something that we can, like most anarthas are just, they're inevitable, but you have to tolerate them and, excuse me, deal with them. But are these anarthas going to inevitably happen?
I mean, not necessarily. It's just like we have to be on the lookout for it, because basically these things are all subtle desires, and If you think of that pastime of Lord Chaitanya cleaning the Gundicha temple, so first he picked out all the big pieces of the big like stones and garbage and straw and things. And then after he got the very fine dust, so these big gross anartas, you know, the lust and the greed and anger and envy and madness and illusion, those are like the stones and the garbage and the straw. And then the dust are these more subtle ones, these subtle ones that you can almost miss, you can not see in your practice of bhakti. So Lord Chaitanya, he taught us that we need to remove all of those. But actually, it's not that we remove them, it's that Krishna removes them. But at the same time, we need to try, we need to do our best, you know, so we need to be on guard. And we need to recognize them and bring them to the attention of Krishna. Like, Krishna, this happened and I felt so proud. You know, this is really bad. This is dangerous. I'm really worried. Can you please help me to deal with this pride? Just, you know, get rid of it before it leads to my downfall. So if we're sincere and we're serious and we're determined, then Krishna will respond to that and he'll help us. Just like, you know, it's really impossible for us to get rid of these on our own, but just like that little sparrow that was trying to drain out the ocean with her tiny beak, and there was no chance. She didn't have a chance. But when Garuda came and helped, then it was like done. So in the same way, we don't have a chance to free ourselves from anartas, but we just need to show Krishna our determination and our sincerity to purify our hearts, and Krishna will do the job. So yeah, we just need to do our best and let Krishna do the rest.
Jai, thank you. I also wanted to comment that was one of the funniest things that I've ever heard. One time you said, it's pretty hard to be proud when you're toothless, you're just gumming it.
Yeah. So sometimes Krishna breaks our teeth. He does that. That's his mercy. Okay, so then after Krishna kills the Keshi demon, then Narada Muni appears, because he just spoke to he just spoke to Kamsa to try to get things to going and get Krishna to go to Mathura, and now he's going to Krishna, and he glorifies him for all the wonderful things he does and all the wonderful things he is, and then he says, this horse demon was so terrifying that his neighing frightened the demigods into leaving their heavenly kingdom. But by our good fortune, you have enjoyed the sport of killing. So then he glorifies him for that particular feat. And then he says, in just 2 days, O Almighty Lord, I will see the deaths of Chanur, Mushtika, and other wrestlers, along with those of the elephant Kuvalayapita and King Kamsa, all by your hand. So here Narada Muni is predicting exactly what Krishna is going to do. In other words, you're going to have to go to Mathura, and all these things are going to happen in just 2 days. So you can't stay lingering around here in Vrindavan, because this is your schedule. It's kind of like the assistant reminding, oh, you have a meeting in 2 hours. So, you know, we need to start getting ready for that. Like, don't stay talking too long here with your friends, or don't let the last meeting go over time, because this next thing is coming soon. So it's like that. It's like, this is great. You killed all these demons. You just finished off Keshi, but you need to now go to Mathura. There's demons there waiting for you that will be killed by you in just a couple of days. Narada Muni has this quality that he knows past, present, and future. So he is aware of what Krishna's plans are. Okay. So now But in any case, after killing Keshi, so Narada Muni, he said that, and then he paid his obeisances and disappeared. He just kind of left that for Krishna to just so you know, just saying, this is going to happen. So just so you know. And then Krishna, Narada Muni goes, and then Krishna, this is the same day in the afternoon that Krishna's out in the forest with his cows and the boys. And so they're playing a game. And this game is kind of like cops and robbers. But what it is, it's shepherds and thieves. So the shepherds are trying to protect the sheep. And these thieves are coming. So some of the boys are shepherds. Some of the boys are sheep. and other boys are thieves. So the boys who are shepherds are trying to guard the sheep, and the boys who are thieves are trying to distract the shepherds. And so one of the boys will distract the shepherds and make him chase him somewhere else. In the meantime, the other thief goes and rounds up some of the boys who are playing sheep and takes them away somewhere and steals them, and hides them. So this game is going on, and they're playing very happily. And then this demon named Vyomasura comes, and he has mystic powers to change his form, like many of the demons do. So he changes himself into a cowherd boy, and he joins the game as one of the thieves. And his intention is to steal the cowherd boys and really hide them and put them in a cave and lock them up. So that's what he does. And he actually manages to steal most of the cowherd boys that were acting as sheep, because he's very powerful and he's not just playing a game. He's like really like putting all of his effort into doing this demoniac thing. So it says here, I'm reading text 29. Gradually, the great demon abducted more and more of the cowherd boys and cast them into a mountain cave, which he sealed shut with a boulder. Finally, only four or five boys acting as sheep remained in the game. So most of them were gone. Lord Krishna, who shelters all saintly devotees, understood perfectly well what Vyomasura was doing. Just as a lion grabs a wolf, Krishna forcefully seized the demon as he was taking away more cowherd boys. Like, haha, got you. You're not getting any more of these boys. So this, Vyomasura, he represents, he's the sky demon. He represents basically fake devotees or people who are not devotees, but who dress up as devotees, just like he's not a cowherd boy, but he took the guise of a cowherd boy. So people who dress themselves up as devotees to enter the temple or to, you know, come into the association of devotees to perform some nefarious activities. So a good example of this is like in Mayapur, that these local thieves, these local like bad people, they dress up as devotees. They put on dhoti, kurta, they get a bead bag and they put it on their hand, and they put on tilak and sika and the whole works. They look like nice devotees, neck beads, everything. But they have no interest in Krishna or devotion to Krishna. They're just going to the temple, and they go during the festival time, especially before Gaur Purnima, when there's many Westerners there. And they go only for the sake of pickpocketing. So they go in there amongst the devotees and they're taking the mobile phones. And sometimes devotees have these like, you know, bum bags. They keep their money and documents and things in. They'll go with a razor blade, cut that on the bottom and just take things out of it. So yeah, they're very, it's very premeditated. It's very like, they're very skillful. And I mean, I know many devotees that got their phones lost from their kurta pocket, because kurta pocket, you know, it's like, it doesn't zip, it doesn't button, it's just open. And because the kurta is loose, then someone can reach their hand in there and take it out without you feeling anything. So that happens. And there are different kinds of people. Like maybe there are some people that they come into the Association of Devotees for doing other things, like, you know, pedophiles. They come into the Association of Devotees. They see that the interactions between devotees are largely based on love and trust, and so a lot of care is not taken, at least in the beginning. Now we've learned our lesson, but in the beginning, not much care was taken to do background checks to find out who these people are and stuff, nor was there a lot of like checks and balances or supervision on what people were doing. So the people who are just pedophiles, they come in, they get a service as a school teacher, and just for the sake of, you know, abusing children. Or people come in and they see that, oh, it's very easy to work your way up in this, you know, they saw that very new devotees, they join and then quickly they become temple commander, they become temple president, they give a lot of responsibilities, they're in charge of temple finances. And so they come in and get into those, they kind of weasel their way into those positions through a lot of just, you know, like pretending to be something that they're not, just for the sake of embezzling funds. So Another example of this is Prakriti Sahajiyas. These Sahajiyas, that they're materialistic people, but they pose as being very great devotees, like they drew. That they think they're gopis or whatever, and they act like that. So the acharyas are very heavy about these people. Actually, there's a name for it. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, they're called Kali Chelas. They're not devotees. They look like devotees, but they're not devotees. They're actually agents of Kali. So it's very heavy. And some of Lord Chaitanya's pastimes, he takes a very severe response to things like, for example, Junior Haridas, looking lustfully on a woman while he's a sannyasi. And some people think, oh, that was just too heavy. But it just shows how much Lord Chaitanya really did not appreciate falsity of any kind. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur also, he was he smashed all these bogus sampradayas, the sahajiyas and all the other ones. So all these, another thing to be careful in the association of devotees. So the keshi was devotees who are actually devotees, but they become bewildered by pride. And they do things that are deviant. They deviate. So then they almost become like non-devotees. And then this is people who are dressing up as devotees and they're actually non-devotees. So these things are some dangerous influences that are, they're kind of insidious. You know, you can't recognize them as immediately as being demoniac because they look like devotees. So we shouldn't be fooled. And these pastimes are here to teach us that we should not be fooled by these types of people. And that's why we're reading in the Nectar of Instruction that we need to discriminate. But in our choosing our association, we need to exercise our intelligence and our discrimination and choose devotees who actually have the good qualities of devotees. It's not discrimination in a negative sense, but it's because these kinds of people are out there and we don't want to associate with them because we don't want to become like them. Okay, so let's see what Krishna does to Vyomasura. Where are we? All right, Krishna grabbed hold of him as he was trying to take away some more boys. And then this is what happens to the demons when they become, when they start fighting with Krishna because they get overpowered, then they're trying to use all their strength to fight back and they can't, it requires a lot of strength to maintain their false form. So then while he's fighting with Krishna, then he is forced to revert into his original form, as big and powerful as a great mountain. So no longer do you look like a little innocent coward boy. Now he looks like a horrendous, huge demon. But try as he might to free himself, he could not do so, having lost his strength from being held in the Lord's tight grip. So yeah, Krishna's got like a death grip on him. Krishna's just like, you're not going anywhere, buddy. Lord Achyuta clutched Vyomasura between his arms and threw him to the ground. Then, while the demigods in heaven looked on, Krishna killed him in the same way that one kills a sacrificial animal. So then it says the acharyas say that the way that the sacrificial animals were killed was by strangulation. So that means that Krishna strangled him. And then Krishna then smashed the boulder. So that's what happens to these people who are like fake devotees. They're posing as devotees for some nefarious thing. Krishna gets a hold of them and he squeezes them. And then he squeezes them. When Krishna puts the squeeze on them, then they have to reveal their own form. And then then everybody comes to see who they really are, and then they get dealt with accordingly. So Krishna eventually reveals these people and sees that they are removed from his devotee association. Krishna then smashed the boulder blocking the cave's entrance and led the trapped cowherd boys to safety. So then he went over and he gave a punch on that boulder that was blocking the cave and released all the devotee, the cowherd boys who were playing the roles of sheep. Thereafter, as the demigods and cowherd boys sang his glories, he returned to his cowherd village, Gokul. So then they all go home after another exciting day in the pasturing grounds, killing Keshi and killing Vyomasura. This is Krishna's days in Vrindavan are always very busy. It's actually on the same day that the next pastime starts, which is Akrura coming to take Krishna to Mathura. All right. We finished the chapter. Any questions or comments or thoughts? Okay then. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gaura Premanandi Hari Hari Bol.